how to find some rational reason for leaving that would answer any question he might pose to himself. Need some air? He thought, rubbing the starchy jacket. Need a smoke? He thought, patting his pocket, inching toward the exit door. He noticed that no one was paying him the slightest attention, but then that was usually the way. His presence or absence mattered to no one, not even to his patients he worried over through the nights. The knob was cold, chilled him through and through. The new paint job, finished in time for this round of visitors, he was sure, was blinding. Buster, walking himself and Nadine closer, his right palm warm, alert to any movement on that side of her stomach, was certain that something was finally happening. He walked them still closer to see what. Mrs. Henry, his neighbor, till she left bed and board, as his parents said sadly, twitched her face, cracked and crazed like the soup tureen in his aunt's china cabinet. Then it was emptied out suddenly of anything he could give a name to. It was just as though Aunt Sudie had gotten up from an unsatisfactory dinner and removed the ladle from the chipped bowl, muttering, then walked to the back door, inched her foot in the crack, then swung it wide with her hip, holding the door back flat with her behind while she dumped the contents into the yard. And for a second there, he'd have been willing to swear that he saw two faces at once on Mrs. Henry, like in an artsy photograph, or like when he took his glasses off too fast, or like he felt sometimes waking with a bump, his night face sinking down behind the day one, and him touching himself to be sure he was there. He patted the mother of his child while he searched for a like that would pin it down so he could be done with it and leave. He would have to be on his toes for the interviews with Dr. Surge and Mr. Cleotis. They had no patience with students who weren't wide awake and all there, like Mrs. Henry's double exposure face was like. He bit his lip and sucked at the mustache coming in, like at the airport at Christmas when his father, home from the islands, turned at the glass and waved, and his father's suntan, like a carnival mask with loose stringing, slipped a bit to the side of his face, and Buster thought it might be time to check his prescription. That wasn't exactly the like, but to hell with like, it always got him in trouble. Never mind what it's like, his father told him, and Nadine told him too. Deal with what it is, Buster, with what it is. He tucked in his top lip and scraped his teeth against the growth he was sure was a manly mustache and pondered the next question. How to be in two places at once? He needed to write up the interviews and hand them in next day, then he'd be done with his coursework until finals. But how to be there in Dr. Surge's office and be there in the treatment room, too, when Mrs. Henry came round? He glanced at Nadine, so intent yet self-preoccupied. She wasn't the most observant or lively reporter. She would no doubt shrug and say nothing much happened. Mrs. Henry just got well, that's all, and then everybody left. He wondered if he really meant to go through with it, marry this girl who was barely his kid sister's age. He grazed his lips and mustache against her temples and hugged her. Gotta go, he whispered. She never looked up his way. Old wife was pulling at Minnie's sleeve.
You're losing your audience, Min. Folks walking out.
I'm gonna lose the patient, too, if you don't give me some directions. She's lost a lot of blood and her system's still full of gas. I just can't seem to generate the energy to bring her back and restore her.
It'll be all right, Min.
Is all right now. Then you can go home and see about yourself. Thinking about home. her slippers, the cushy couch, the throw rugs that would be bright and clean of cat fur and nutshells. The widow lady and her lodger had been at it all morning, and she'd be overwhelmed at the door with lemon oil and ammonia. Or, if the lodger had been allowed a free hand, the floors would be slick with Van-Van polish and the whole house reeking of Peaceful House Incense No. 9. They did their best, but all she really wanted was for someone to drive the porch nails down so she could go barefoot, and for someone to move the cord of wood from the yard to the window within reach of the couch, and for someone to fix her kitchen window, propped up since Christmas with a stick of firewood. It didn't seem too much to ask. It didn't seem too much to get done for a woman who could get patients up off the surgeon's table, for a woman who could get patients to throw off their stitches, for a woman who could drive snakes out of folks' heads. But she wanted someone to do it without her leading them. She thought of Dr. Meadows, wandering about in front of the infirmary, studying the glyphs the old masons had chiseled into its face, reading the memorial plaques and glancing about toward the bus terminal, toward the park, as if not sure which way to ramble. And she saw herself on the porch with her silver tea set, legs crossed, swinging her new beige tea-strap suede, brushing the crease in his gray slacks. The doctor leaning in the rocker, telling her all about himself. Free to go anywhere at all in the universe, Minnie muttered. So why do I choose to be bothered with this gal? But knowing that at the first sign of a shift on the stool, or a signal from old wife, or a word from within, she would tear past the flower beds, race back along the path, sunk up to her hem in hot sand, and tilting, would race down the cliffs to Velma Henry's side to take up the yoke and pull toward life. Love, men. Love won't let you let her go. I'm not the least ways worried, 'cause it's got everything to do with good. Love. Good. God. She don't want that. Getting so none of them want that. The children are spoiling old wife. Want their loving done with sweet tooth cupcakes and shiny cars and credit cards and grins from white folks. You believe that, or just carrying on like your patients? Oh, you've seen 'em out there in deep waters, showing off, forgetting everything they ever knew about sharks and the undertow. Why then you rip them fancy clothes off, men, and thrash out into them waters? Churn up all them bones we dropped from the old ships. Churn up all that brine from the salty deep where our tears sank. And you grab them cheering by the neck and bop 'em a good one and drag 'em on back to shore and fling 'em down and jump to it, pumping and cussing, fussing and cracking they ribs if you have to let 'em live. Men, 'cause love won't let you let 'em go. But they want to go. That's the hurtin' part. Like you told the lap sitter this morning, men, when you hurt, hurt. But when you see the cheerin' callin' down thunder and goin' up in flames, men, why then you snatch you a blanket, a scabby, foul-smellin' blanket off one of them mules we nary saw hide nor hair of, nor acres neither. What you know about a mule blanket, Minnie Ransom? What on earth would you do with a mule and some acres? You was raised on eiderdowns and girls on wages fixing your breakfast on a tray. You sitting up here with your special-made clothes on and lingerie with letters on 'em talking about you'd know how to get next to a mule long enough to get they blanket. And I'd throw that blanket over them cheerin's head like a kidnap-snatchin' sack and throw 'em on the ground and roll 'em in the dirt and jump all over them to smother out the flames till fire turn 'em loose and they can live. Like you say, old gal, The cheering are our glory.
See, I told you, men, you'd be feeling better once we got to chapel.
We can't stay long now. The Loa are setting up to make music for Velma to dance by. We got to free her up from fire and water so she don't drown in air like some back-ass fish.
Men,
then we got to summon one of the Loa to see after the Henry gal's recuperation for some god-slight notion lurking around near her master brain turn her water wrong.
Men,
check the moon, old wife. Sun's up in a firesome way between the men and the women, and I don't want to get caught short of teas and things. Sophie gonna have to recruit some of these youngsters and train 'em at gathering.
I'ma get my walking shoes soon, men, 'cause them haints fixin' to beat on them drums with them cat bones and raise a ruckus. So you just leave me here and I'll talk to you after a while. I can't stand all that commotion them haints callin' music.
Old wife, what are you but a haint?
I'm a servant of the Lord, begging your pardon.
I know that, but you a haint. You dead, ain't you?
There is no death in spirit, men. I keep telling you.
Why you so hard-head? You and that gal on the stool cut from the same cloth, and a rough bolt of dry goods it is, too.
Yes,
well, I'll hold that thought. But meanwhile, let's get on with the business at hand. I want to go home, set my hair, and brew some tea.
Expecting company tonight.
Winking.
Minnie Ransom. I'm gonna be right there on the porch with you, so you best be prepared to put aside any hussy notions about messing with that doctor man, you heifer.
Lord, I hope you are recording this all. I hope you are beaming down on this scene I never auditioned for, Lord. Hope you see how your humble servant got her hands over full with both the quick, not so quick, and the dead. So when I petition you, Lord, with feeble praise and bold requests, don't turn me down now. Gotta help me and answer my prayers.
So little faith. Your prayers are always answered, men.
This I know, but sometimes the answer is no, old wife. Look who I got for a spirit guide, an old stick-in-the-mud who don't even remember from one session to the next the diagnoses and the treatment. Sweet Jesus.
Be careful, men Ransom. You heading for a fall. I'm not even sure you deserve your gift.
Old wife, good and bad and deserve and the rest of that stuff have got nothing, I'm telling you, nothing to do with it. Now, you hold that thought while I get on back there and put on some music for the folks.
3. What's with Palma?
Cecile had been looking out the bus window.
Had a vexing dream about Velma. I guess that's why we're on our way to the Claiborne Festival.
What's her sign?
Palma's.
Kiss me, Nick. You, the staunch Marxist, Maoist, dialectical, historical materialist who is always plenty short-mouthed about the buzzwire elements in the improvisations. You, the hard-nosed scientific bullshit detector. You, Inez, want to know Palma's sign?
Backside.
But I'm not a materialist. I'm Chicana.
No, hear me out. Mai leaned forward.
Who's got the color film for the bell and howl?
Pass the thermos, one of the members of the troupe said.
Cecile, you got your screwdriver handy or a nail file?
Because the material without the spiritual and psychic does not a dialectic make.
Gotcha.
What's this vile and loathsome brew, Chesia?
Yerba mate, nectar of the gods.
Her gods, Inez, are not our gods, O sister of Dicon.
Obviously.
Your gods still alive, Chesia.
The screwdriver's married to the hammer, Nilda.
You must take the whole sack and return it in one lump, if you please.
Ask the driver if we can open the windows. The air conditioning is off, I think.
The driver was listening to the young woman just behind him. The front of her T-shirt read, Seven Sisters.
Ilani, my old comrade at the barricades, sitting on a mat with a shaved head, nibbling on a communion wafer and sipping distilled water through a glass straw. Tibetan wind chime music on the box. No Coltrane in sight and no conversation except an occasional om. It trips me out. The changes. And meanwhile, Baki and Carter and the KKK and the Nazis and COINTELPRO not skipping a beat.
Any chance of our doing a mural for the Academy of the Seven Arts?
Mai was trying to get Palma's attention.
We've got a suitcase full of paints under the bus.
We're staying on after Carnival or whatever it is, yes?
Palma, when exactly does the Claiborne Festival start?
The bus driver, halting at the railroad crossing, eavesdropped on the conversations around him. In the seats to the side and behind were the colored women who'd gotten on in Barnwell with satchels and bags and knapsacks, all in bossy T-shirts. No nukes. Stop the Esmeralda. Get the U.S. out of... It would have meant staring at unbridled bosoms to read it all. He guessed he was old-fashioned, like his son said, only that wasn't the term his son had used. The clang, clang, and winking lights, left, right, were doing something to him. He searched through his crossword puzzle repertoire for the word, any word, a word to worry over the spelling of to distract him from the lights. He might have found one. But it was too damn hot to think, and it was overheating underfoot, too, scorched metal fumes in his face, scraping his throat, burning his eyes. He slid the window open and hung his cap on the hook. He'd have to do something about his hair. The office was leaning on all the gray hairs. For years, they hadn't hired colored guys. Now, just when he was getting some seniority, they were talking about early retirement.
Before we sit down to work out the program with the brothers from the academy, we need to go through these folders. These are the skits and poems and some of the posters from International Women's Day.
He hung on to the talk around him, lest he overheat too. He felt light and feverish, as though he might float away in delirium any minute, leaving 31 passengers stranded. Which might not be a bad idea, he was thinking. His teeth bared in a grin or a sneer. He wasn't sure which. Too hot to care. And it had been one crummy lunch, and he was late, and he couldn't afford to blow the extra job, the chartered bus of doctors visiting the infirmary. And the train was taking its own sweet mile-long time.
Mai, change seats with Nilda and help me with this. A piece on John Henry and Quan Chung, the spirit of I am. Something like that. We never did work it through.
The Central and Union Pacific race for profit.
We could do it as a mime and narrative musical for Sister of the Rice and Sister of the Yam.
Anything to do with metal should be done by the brothers, I think. Unfortunately, they are all black at the academy, aren't they? And for the Quan character... Would you care to expound a bit on that, unfortunately, before Sister Palma of the Yam and Sister Cecile of the Plantain whip out their switchblade and machete, respectively?
You think Velma might join us? Do the music, Palma?
John Henry and Quan Chung. I'll take the notes. Keep talking.
Some notes, the driver, Fred Holt, thought. He mopped his face with a handkerchief. He'd like a gander at those notes. For 3 hours, the women in the T-shirts had been fumbling with cameras, tape recorders, weird machines, clipboards, notepads, babbling about corn and rice and plutonium bombs and South Africa and Brer Rabbit and palm oil and the CIA and woodcuts. Now, John Henry. If he knew a good psychiatrist to recommend to them, he would. If he could keep the sweat out of his eyes long enough,
He'd like to look over those notes himself. Women.
Look. He stole a glance around. The tall Indian woman who wore a man's hat with an oily black feather stuck in the band was mashed up against the window pane, pointing up. He followed her finger, scooting down in his seat to see. A flock of birds in a low swoop over the train was sharply changing direction and heading back over the roadway as if pulled by an invisible hook. He thought of what his buddy Porter had said the night they watched the moon walk and the shots of the earth going through 3 six-packs without batting an eye. Porter, talking about going to where the ice ends and the Antarctic meets the dark southern oceans of the great whales. And he had listened in a blurry way as Porter had droned on and on about dying before he ever got to see all of the earth from that view.
"Only the albatross," he'd said, like he was reciting a poem. "The albatross and the swift and the shearwater see it all at once."
And he wondered if Porter wanted to be an astronaut or a bird or what. Poor, poor bastard. "Arrows in the sky," the woman in the hat said, licking 2 fingers and smoothing the feather from its fat to its taper.
"The arrow of Ra," someone else muttered, the one who hadn't had too much to say since boarding in Barnwell.
He didn't hear what the other women said, abandoning for a moment the machines they took apart, cleaned, oiled, fondled lewdly, was the way he felt it, jerking them off, cranking handles, blowjob on the lenses. He chuckled. They leaned into the windows and were talking all at once. What was there to say about this perfectly ordinary sight? A bunch of birds doing what birds do? Porter, though, might have pointed out what there was to see, what was escaping his eye, would have made a poem out of how they ride the currents, ride sheer sunlight. Porter would have had something hip to say. Fred Holt wiped his face again, wiped his shades, dangling them by one stem, then stuffed the damp handkerchief back into his pocket. The train was roaring in, and he was alert now, not drifting, so no more need of the women, their words, their presence, to anchor him. Besides, half the time they were talking Spanish or West Indian or some other language. The only one who spoke good English was the Jap, or maybe she was a Chink. Though even in regular English they rambled, interrupting each other, finishing off each other's sentences. Baffling. He hadn't heard a word from the 2 fat ladies behind them in a while, rattling tin foil and juggling paper plates on their laps, determined, it seemed, to eat their way across country. They'd been talking at him a blue streak from the minute they got on until the colored women got on in Barnwell. So that was a blessing. He didn't have to answer a bunch of dumb questions about how he liked being a bus driver, about the route, about where one could get a good hot meal in this or that town. They were content now to talk to each other and leave him alone.
"You figure epidemics then, Gracie. Have another. Bake them myself.
My son-in-law says Legionnaire's disease is just the beginning. He says those doctors do not know what they're doing playing around with viruses and germs and things. Will kill us all, my son-in-law says. He works in a hospital, my son-in-law does. A matter of reap what you sow, I guess. But innocent people, Gracie. Chickens coming home to roost. But what about the people who haven't done anything, Gracie? Date nut bread with orange peel. You must give me this recipe. I don't want to die, Gracie. I think the government should stop those doctors, take away their licenses, tie them up with their own stethoscopes. Did I tell you what that doctor who took out my you-know-what had the nerve to say to me when I told him about all the gas I was letting out? Most embarrassing. The train was thundering by, jiggling Fred Holt in his seat. Wood, coal, racks of jeeps, sealed cars with stenciled lettering revealing nothing at all about the contents. He'd heard they shipped trash from nuclear plants in cars like that. Flat cars, bearing the weight of freight cars he usually saw traveling under their own steam when he did the run from St. Louis to Memphis. Dirty yellow, smudged orange,
rust, gunmetal gray going by. Hear that long, lonesome whistle, riding the blinds. Please, please, Mr. Brakeman, let a po' boy ride your train. Oh, the Rock Island line is a mighty good. How long has the evening train been gone? I'm Alabama bound. Then, a clear view. A clear view of eat, gas, rooms, don't litter, post, no bills, no trespassing. Jesus loves you. On his left, up ahead, a salvage yard, bathtubs and kitchen sinks. Old men in tatters huddled around a burning trash can. One carefully spreading newspaper across another one lying down by an upturned tub. It could be the Depression again, he was thinking. The old bum on the ground could be dead, starved to death. He thought of the Depression years, of how the neighbors at night used to trade flour and beans and salt pork in the shadows of the tool sheds on the QT, lest word got out food was around and they'd get hit in the head. How his father and mother would send him the back way to deliver sacks of sweet potatoes or meal to the poorer families. How the women would accept the food, say thanks, and move off. How the men would drop their eyes and scuff their boots in the dirt and mumble and keep him standing there. How his own family ate with the lights off and the shades pulled down. How they wouldn't eat at all till his father's older brother got in from the trains, food from the dining cars wrapped in napkins and stuffed in shoeboxes. How they ate again when his father reopened the store, the platters near full, his father standing over them all with a stick, and they better not grab. A fat man with three different colored sweaters on rushed out of a shack and chased the old bums away. Yes, it could be the Depression all over again. It is, he thought, lips drawn back. But he couldn't afford to think too long of that. The pension fund scandal, still front page news, and all the talk about oil rationing and food shortages, and his years slipping by and prices being what they are. Inflation, inflation. Why you want to be so mean? I got the high price blues and I... Porter said that pretty soon the only work the likes of them would be able to get was in those nuclear plants. The rate those places are falling apart, Porter had said, showing him some of the articles he was always tearing out of the papers. They'll only hire the old. And Fred had had to dampen his fingers to spread the newsprint flat and to read quickly about the plants constructed right after the war. Their war. How they were rapidly coming apart now. That way, Porter said, putting another clipping down to read, smoothing out the crease and tearing it some. We old workers are dead and gone before anybody can do a study about the effects of radiation on workers. And Fred had nodded, then muttered, cold-blooded, quickly reading over the second item about a suit against a chemical plant by workers who'd left years ago and were dying of cancer. That's all the good we old-timers'll be, Porter had said, folding the articles neatly into his billfold. Now you watch, pointing his bread knife in the direction of the infirmary. Those big shots over at Transchemical will level that place before long. Too many agitator types over there, the educated kind too, and they're collecting information about conditions at the plant. Its effect on our lungs, I bet. Probably making tests. And Fred had stared out the diner window toward the building he'd been meaning to go by for the longest time for a checkup. But not if agitators hung round there. He'd had enough trouble in life. Fred Holt fingered the bumps and grooves of the steering wheel and tried not to be sick, tried not to think about the lunch or about Porter. He hunched over the wheel, staring out and daring himself to go get a checkup at the infirmary. Passing on his right was a huge plain of mud, red like the deep red mud near the river mouth behind the old house when he was in short pants, then knickers. A plain of fresh destruction, he composed, as if to report this sight. to Porter. Not there when last he had this route. Stores gutted, car shells overturned, a playground of rust and twisted steel, mounds of broken green bottle glass, rusted bed springs, bald tires, doors off their hinges leaning in the wind, flower pot shards, and new-looking brick and lumber strewn about, but not haphazardly, as if a crew had brushed them off with profit in mind. Panes of glass up against a half wall for pickup later looked like. A project not long ago put up was now this pile of rubble, and in the middle of it all, a crater. He specially did not want to look at that, not in all this heat, not with his stomach churning up the lousy lunch. No time for another rest stop. Late as hell, no way to make it by 3:10 p.m., and them bastards just looking for the chance to dump him before pension time. Same old number, he thought, rumbling over the tracks. Redevelopment, progress, the master plan. Cut back in services, declare blight, run back from the suburbs and take over. There'd be no Hoover towns sprouting up here. There'd be high-rises and boutiques next time through. Blondes with dogs on leashes and teenage kids on bikes and parking lots and station wagons and new street lights and... He sucked his teeth. Niggers. Compliant, movable niggers forever going for the okey-doke. He dropped his eyes into his lap and the light and the blue shadows there fed his mind's adventures. A raid on the lumberyards, taking over construction companies, the revolving drum of the cement mixer. Him riding shotgun on a derrick and crane, new housing going up and him going up in a glass elevator with a hard hat on. Schools, playgrounds, stores, clinics, and they, the older men the young ones were quick to call over the hill and through, would defend it all with guns.
What's the delay?
A voice from the middle of the bus. Exactly. There'd been too much delay, and he meant to do his part before they wiped him out. Maybe he hadn't done all he could do to help his boy through school. Maybe he'd been too much the worried father, too much the angry father, too much the put-aside father. In those days when the boy, suddenly a man and making decisions he couldn't go with, was going to jail every time he turned around. But he was nobody's Tom, nobody's good nigger. Nobody sit around on the porch, fool. He was still fumbling with the gear stick as he slowly passed what had once been a lot of people's homes. Home one minute, a crater the next. Flower boxes, stoops, lawns slipping into the maw of the mechanical monster. The bite of the hydraulic bit breaking up potsy courts and basketball courts over and over in fuck you repetition. How long? How long? A gaping hole, a grave, a pit, nothing to even pass by in a car with the grandchildren on a Sunday drive and to point to and say, nothing. Nothing. Like the home he'd known for too short a time, but a sweet time for a while. Pruitt Igoe, raised up in a monument one minute, blown up in a volcano the next. And near the crater that had been their home was the pit that had been the elevator shaft, down which he'd dropped sensen wrappers and matchbooks with phone numbers on them, lest Wanda jump salty with him. And down at the bottom of the shaft, the other dumpage. 11 dead bodies, the rotted remains of bill collectors, drug dealers, wives, husbands, raped and missing girls of East St. Louis.
What's happening, my man?
The musician with the horn case in his lap was getting impatient. Exactly. What? Everything ruined and wrecked, made old and garbage before its time. He picked his way carefully through memories to keep from tripping over one that might cost him too much, like his lunch. The chili he should have known better, but ordered anyhow. On his last run to Memphis, he'd gone to look at his young man haunts. The bakery shut down. The hardware store that sold everything and was perfect for hanging out in to get the news boarded up. The Palace, a ghost place. Shreds of Bills, featuring Booker White, Willie Dixon, Muddy, Bilbo, hanging near unreadable from the falling walls. Church's Park, deserted. No tents, no more music. As if Bobby Bland and BB had been done gone, and he had no past and no future.
Hey, my man, we're trying to make a gig.
He wrenched the stick into gear and tried to ignore the grinding and the hacking cough erupting from under the bus. Grateful one minute, seething the next, he turned onto the highway, searching in the mirror for the bastard rushing him, reminding him of how little it would take to lose his damn job and blow his retirement. One of the musicians, it was, who'd boarded at the old post office, not a regular stop anymore, but what the hell? There they were, beside a broke-down van. So what could he do? They'd stopped, it seemed, to get sandwiches and use the phone, mail some letters, stretch their legs, and the battery had got pinched and some instruments, too. Or maybe the tires. Or the motor. Something like that. He might have gotten it straight, might have sympathized, given advice, might have eased into the old what-you-know-bro he'd prided himself on in the beginning before the job turned sour. But not anymore. Damn fools, full-grown men, you'd think they'd know enough not to go off altogether. Musicians. No, sir, he didn't have a mumbling word to say. Drive the bus and mind your own damn business was his policy now. So many guys laid off behind some simple shit like a passenger complaining that the driver had gotten too familiar. Shit. It was the big fella with the alligator horn case, he figured, seemed to be the leader, had a loused-up mouth, looked like some prison dentist had got hold of him. Fred knew about that, a half-ass examination with what felt like a pickaxe in the mouth, then the grabbing up of pliers, not even a glance at the mixing plates, not a thought to the tubes of filling stuff. Just cold pliers coming at you to let you know your teeth like you are beyond salvation. He wondered if the big fella's ruined smile ruined the lip, too, and approaching the horn again was like coming back to a woman you hadn't held in 4 long years. Wondered if you had to court the horn. Shy and clumsy all over again, fearing that what was missing was more than teeth. Was something so deep down and necessary there'd be no getting back to how things had been in the sweet time. He wondered if the big fellow with the bad mouth had had better luck with his comeback than he had had with Wanda. Least he had a gig. But what did he, Fred Holt, hard worker for nearly 40 years, have? But he didn't want to think about that or feel any kind of anything for the big fella. He had a gig, fine. And that was that. It was hot, and the gears were slipping. Maybe the cotter pin was getting chewed up in the axle. Some new young jerk in the yard had changed the wheel. No telling what he was on, goofy and full of noise. The wheel could come off. Fine. Behind schedule, stopping for them musicians and trying to find change, then stopping again to try to quiet down them damn fool white folks getting a head start on their convention blast, or whatever it was they were going to Claiborne for, and the drunken couple he'd threatened twice, actually pulling over to the shoulders to put off the bus. Though he'd welcomed a chance to stop, get out, splash his face with the remains of his iced tea, but he'd never make it to the terminal by 3. It was nearly 10 of, as it was, and any minute the bus might do who knew what. So he'd probably have to toss a coin, a nap or some dinner, 'cause there was that charter run to make with the doctors at that infirmary place, and he sure needed the dough. They were pitching beer cans out the windows, the loud mouths in the stupid hats. But damn if he wasn't going to point to the sign overhead, read the regulations, recite the law. If he got flagged down, he'd just tell the cop to take them in, haul them all in for his money. Getting so, people didn't know how to act anymore. They talked in the movies like they were at home with the TV where any old off-the-wall shit was okay.
but at least the beer drinkers had gotten the hymn singers to shut up, so that was something in their favor. Though, when the Jesus types had gotten on at the farmer's market in their rummage sale clothes, with their battered suitcases and juiceless faces, carrying their Bibles and their hymn books, he had hoped their presence would put a halt to the risque jokes and the foul-mouthed gab of the conventioneers. That was the least they could do, bringing all that gloom onto the bus. That was what white folks like that were supposed to do, he figured. Check other white folks in their madness instead of leaving it to black folks, who had enough to do given all the crazy niggers and white folks, too, they had to deal with day in and day out. But looked like their off-key singing and no spunk praying or just plain being there only egged the characters in the hats on, slinging naked lady magazines around the bus and standing up in the seats to make underarm farts. White folks. But at least things were pretty quiet now, like the two camps of whiteys were holding each other down. Stabilized. There was a good puzzle word. He formed the letters, blocked them neatly in the boxes, then gave himself over to the black and white patterns in his mind. J.D.?
I'm listening.
What say we lay over in this hick town a while, the one we going to, and get somebody to drive the car up? We ain't booked nowhere else yet.
Suits me.
Say, J.D.
I'm listening.
What name were you born with? All kidding aside.
Ask your mama.
Fred Holt glanced at the big fella in the mirror. He was grinning, and a messed up grin it was. Whatever that gig paid, he ought to use it to get his mouth fixed up, Fred was thinking. The grin was sure private and just as well. Enough to scare little children. Whatever his name was, it was clear that he thought it made him a friend to his horn. He was hugging the case with one arm, drumming a little paradiddle with his other hand. He'd heard the old musicians talking when he was a kid, and used to sit there in the hall of Miss Hazel's boarding house, hugging his knees. That naming was no miscellaneous matter. You took a name and gave your acts a name that made you both amiable to the music. They made it sound like this music was a person who could be called over and made to work for you. He'd wanted to be a musician, except he never got around to learning anything worthwhile. What he could do on a harmonica didn't amount to a hill of beans. And two, he'd really wanted to be some kind of outdoor worker, a builder, thick, leathery gloves with the fingers cut out, a hard hat, tough work boots. Old Jimmy Lyons, who used to tear up the Hammond organ over at Stomp It, had told him he was a four, and fours were builders, but lots of fours never got around to doing what they were put on the earth to do because they were so busy feeling boxed in by them four sides of their nature that they didn't have sense to look up and appreciate all that space they could build into. And Jimmy Lyons had told him another thing, that the Negro people were fours, and so long as they paid more attention to folks trying to pin them in, hem them in, box them in on all four sides, thinking they had them in prison than to the work at hand, why then they would never get a spare moment to look up at the sun and build. That Jimmy Lyons was one philosophizing fool. Porter would have liked him. They would have taken to each other right off. But then they would have been so delighted with each other's company, Fred wouldn't have been able to get a word in edgeways. Something made him look toward the back of the bus. Something strong and not to be denied pulled him from the past to make him straighten up and check out the boy with the wire basket in the center of the back seat. Of course, snakes. He'd had an inkling it was something weird when the strange-looking youth had got on. Goddamn snakes. On his bus. Who would believe that? Who, in fact, could he even tell it to anymore? Snakes. Can you manage that? He might have said to Porter, and Porter would have said right back, can you live? Can a nigger live? But Porter was dead. Porter was dead, and he was driving an unsafe bus with drunken white folks, severe, righteous whiteys looking just like the ones in the lynch mob pictures, a pack of strange-talking women with trouble-making shirts, and a retarded-looking farm kid with a basket of snakes. "Beat me, Jesus," he muttered. "Beat me all in my chest. Snakes. Can you manage that?" There'd be no one to pick up the cue anymore. A pair of knitting needles had seen to that. Two goddamn needles stuck in Porter's neck at the pit stop. Some in-a-hurry passenger taking exception to Porter's second slice of pie, or to his neat look and fresh smell of bay rum and talc, or to the way he hadn't answered. Who knew why? Not a single Claiborne paper could piece together a story from the witnesses, and not a single witness could offer a description of the woman.
"It was a woman,"
the counter girl had told him when Fred had asked, hiccuping so hard through the telling he couldn't make sense of any of it. So no one could say whether she was black, white, blonde, fat, or a bear in a wig or a moose in a dress. For all he knew, she could be on this run. The drunken woman with hair like granite, blubbering chatter, trying to talk to one of the colored guys, or one of them t-shirts. Knitting needles. Snakes. Can you manage that? Life was a danger, and every minute. Wasn't that Porter's theme song? You're minding your business, staying off the streets, paying your bills, and trying to make a go of your marriage. And some asshole expert releases radioactive fumes in the air and wipes you out in your chair reading the funnies. "As we sit here," Porter used to say, grabbing the edge of the counter, "we are dying from overexposure to some kind of wasting shit. The radioactive crap, asbestos particles, noise, smog, lies." And Fred would nod and push his plate away. "Palma, were you able to reach anyone at home?" Mai was leaning across the aisle. "No answer."
"You all right?"
Who was there to say, "Fred, you all right?" Or, "Pass the thermos to Fred. He looks a bit overheated." Porter, the only other colored guy on the shift, used to hail him, "Hey, Fred, how's your hammer hanging?" And he'd mount the stool and holler back, "It ain't ruined my crease none." And the pit stop would become an okay place despite the gluey pie and the specials that tasted just like the regular fried newspaper meals. It beat going home. His home was beginning to feel more like a trailer every day than a house, the kind of trailer he imagined they made dirty movies in, the kind of dirty movies he always watched holding his breath, expecting Margie to turn up in them, for there was always someone who looked like her. Big, sloppy tits, rough skin, never quite clean, doing something low down near the end of the movie. Margie. With her streaked and stringy hair and flat ass, acting like she was some kind of movie star, prancing about the house in her drawers, giving him her back at night like he was supposed to be grateful for whatever she offered. But he couldn't talk about that with Porter. Porter was a race man, so for all the time of their friendship, he'd never once invited him home for supper or talked about any wife but Wanda. But Wanda had left years ago. Now, Porter was dead. Porter had to bribe a doctor to get his papers through and get the job with the bus company. Some kind of wasting disease was eating him up. Yucca Flats, 1955, Atomic Test Blasts, his theme song. That might be something to chat about with the t-shirts if the bus broke down. Hospitalized, discharged, no compensation, no records, not service-connected, they said. Goodbye, get lost, buddy, drop dead. "She stabbed him," they said, in the side of his neck as he leaned into his cup, lips pursed, hot coffee. "He fell," they said, "like cattle fall in the stockyards. Yucca Flats, pit stop. It was enough to make a grown man weep, enough to make you mean, make you want to wrench the wheel and drive the bus right through the rails and into the marsh. So easy to do. The crunchable rails rolling past, dull gray, bent and rusted here and there. So easy. The embankment sloping down a bit toward the swamp punk. So easy. He'd often dreamt of it, and the dreams hadn't scared him at all. He'd been intrigued with the notion of sinking and of being on the embankment, watching. Being in the grasses, hearing the thick gurgling as the waters sucked the bus under. He often thought of it, of what it would be like, lying there at night, resting on his arm and projecting pictures on the ceiling. He wouldn't have to look at Margie's blue flannel back. Speeding past the marshes, Fred Holt was brimming over with rage and pain and loss. He watched the upcoming rush of rails with such intensity, could see the bus crashing through the metal and thundering through the bushes down to the depths with such searing clarity, it etched an imprint on the surroundings, an imprint that became magnetized, drawing substance to it, sucking plasma from the underbrush creatures, draining colors from the trees and shrubs, snatching sound from birds, crickets, and from Fred Holt's lungs, pulling life to it for manifestation in a tangible form. A complete happening it would become for any daydreamy hitchhiker who might walk that way, for any of the bus passengers who might look that way, off guard, susceptible. Porter. So neat, so well-read, so unfull of shit. One of the few guys around who could talk about something other than pussy, poker, pool, and TV. Had wanted to be a newspaper reporter, go all over the world, go to Africa, and see what that was like. They used to sit on them stools in the pit stop like truck drivers with their knees out and talk about Africa, piecing together whatever they knew and trusted to counter the hooey handed them in news magazines. They'd sit there with their knees out while the whores, half of them with jaws like Joe Palooka, 5 o'clock shadows and all, sat side saddle at either end of the counter eyeing them like they'd ever be that hard up. And they'd talk about family. Fred's in New York, Porter's wife and kids in Canada, and the kids spinning around on the stools would interrupt, begging a quarter for the jukebox. They argued the merits of growing up in Memphis or in Harlem. Porter talked about Speaker's Corner, calling it holy ground. Fred would talk about the tenements behind Beale Street they used to call the Arks. They'd laugh together at their father's old-time courting tales when they'd jam a tomato steak with their name chalked on it in the girl's yard and hope like hell her father wouldn't come yank it out and fling it back over the fence. Or about their own courting days. Fred sitting up in the palace with his hat in Wanda's lap, Porter sitting up in the Apollo with his arm around Irene, his thumb grazing her breast. And hunched over the liver and onions with no smell to it, they'd talk about the characters in Claiborne, the slick-time gangster who called himself Doc Surge and ran the infirmary that never paid its bills but managed to stay open somehow. Portland Edgers, who, like Porter, had been a race man, but wasn't quite the same after that time he'd had to beat the woman who was taking in all the civil rights workers. Jay Patterson, with his shit-eating grin, who never remembered your name but always wanted to shake your hand, would shake your hand 2 and 3 times a day and try to pin a button on you, and James Lee Henry, who ran the Academy of Seven Arts, where it was rumored the stash of guns and ammunition stolen from the armory was hidden. The old geezer they called the Hermit, 'cause he lived behind high hedges in a dark house and only once in a blue moon came out, like at carnival when he'd make a speech in the park and then slip away. Of course, toward the end, Porter had made it impossible to speak any other way but reverently of the Hermit. But whatever they talked about, Porter always managed to bring it round to Yucca Flats, 1955, atomic blasts, no compensation. The man was haunted, and now he was gone. Spun around on a stool by some crazy bitch with no better place to put her knitting needles but in a good man's life. What would he do now with his fitful nights but rehearse bus accidents on the ceiling or glare at Margie's back and get dangerous? He saw it dart out from the marshes, scoot under the shrubs at the railing, saw it run out onto the highway and stop, its eyes like road reflectors, a dark and furry thing offering itself up. So he took it. Eyes right on it, foot to the floor, he killed it, felt it go lumpy, then smushy in the wheel, and he dropped his hands away one at a time to wipe them on his pants. Barreling down the highway away from it, he kept his eyes strictly off the rearview mirror. He felt hot and swarmy, felt the chili turning on him. If he could just make it to the terminal before it caught up with him. But already it was rushing him, and he was helpless to keep ahead of it, could smell it jamming up his nostrils, jamming up his lungs. Fire. The fire that time, and him leaning against the house, throwing up his insides. Trees like blazing giants with their hair aflame, crashing down in the fields, turning corn, grass, the earth, black. Birds falling down out of the sky, burnt and sooty like bedraggled crows. The furniture blistering, crackling, like hog skins crackled on Granddaddy's birthday. His mother dragging the mattress out, sparking and smoldering, beating it with her slipper, and the matting jumping like popcorn all over the front yard, and her screaming, screaming at him as if she knew. And she probably did. His pop store coming away from the house, leaning over and crashing down. The store, a hole in the ground, and just the apples stored in its cellar recognizable. Him standing in the piece of doorway swaying, char and ash sucking at the soles of his feet, threatening to take him under the few floorboards left down past the apples and straight to hell for what he'd done. Swaying in the doorway, not a doorway. Tar gas filling up his mouth and lungs, and all the sun that ever was crowding in behind him to make him look down where Pop had been, where a lone tin can was now, its label scorched away, a scorched patch of label here, a shine there, and whatever it held about to explode. Beans, soup, tomatoes, okra, about to explode in his face, knocked off the shelf, maybe in the first cave-in, pushed to the side by a falling beam. It had gotten smacked to the side by the hoses drowning the place, and gotten finally stopped by his father's head before the men gripped him by his stocking feet and dragged him out, taking their time. Speed no longer mattered for Pop. And then he was alone with the tin can parked at his feet, accusingly growing fatter and fatter and ready to explode. He felt like he was sitting on burrs. He couldn't afford to stop again, not with the hot metal smell and the lateness. He just might make it. But one more holler from the Grand Wizard or whatever the Joker in the spangled hat was, one more cranking of a camera, one more anything, and he'd snatch free the pistol taped under seat and blow their fucking heads off. All of them. The pains in the ass and the ones who hadn't yet given him any trouble. Not yet. But they all did, eventually. Loyal, loving, there one minute, gone the next, troubling, but he'd gotten over Wanda and had rewarded himself with blonde hair. Soft, caring, one minute, pain in the ass the next, face to the wall, in a stew, in a freeze, giving him back talk or worse, just her back and no talk at all. And of course, when he got home tonight, he could count on her to ask him the same dumb thing.
Have a nice trip, Freddy.
No sleep, brains cooked, lousy meals, the worst shift, porter dead, uniform a mess. So she had it coming. I ran over a coon, as in raccoon, not to be confused with the coons your daddy used to lynch. And she'd cry. Not for him, not for his chafed neck and his jounced nuts, his loss, his threatened pension, but for herself and some dead animal. There'd be no washcloth in the freezer for his face, no tub run, no jug of tea with chipped ice and sliced lemon to drink, sloshing in the sudsy water. There'd be no decent meal to get down to make up for the chili that had his bowels in a knot, and no intelligent conversation. Just the hot, still air of the dirty movie trailer house smelling like spoiled chops burning in an unclean oven, and her blubbering on about the dead coon on the highway till she was too swollen and bleary and ugly to do anything but hit. But he might not even get the chance. The tin can of a bus, stuffed and overheated, any minute might explode. Snakes popping in the air like the frogs he slung from the mound back of the house, watching them pop and his mother damning his murdering soul to hell. Hymnals fluttering out of them beat-up suitcases, music cases snapping open and guitar strings popping, cartridge tape spiraling across the highway, a tangle, and the cameras catching it all somehow in time for the 6 o'clock news. Rage, sorrow, sour kidney beans and rice rose up in his throat with shredded cow spilling its terror of the slaughterhouse hammer into his mouth. He dug out the damp handkerchief, hands like claws, and vomited.
Driver, you okay?
I want to tell you people that my husband here beats up on me.
Give us a break and drop dead, lady, will ya?
Nilda. Pass up the napkins.
What's the trouble up there? Hey, you're supposed to stand behind the white line, for Christ's sake.
Don't never lose your mind on holidays or have big trouble, because all them hospital beds are full up and the doctors are on vacation.
Have a drink, lady, and forget it.
What's going on up there? A summit goddamn conference, for Christ's sake?
Driver, pull over and let these rummies off. They're stinking up the bus. Hey, driver, you, boy.
Watch that shit. I wasn't talking to you. I'm talking to you. Watch that boy shit.
Another napkin, somebody. He'll be okay.
Who the hell are you?
The boy who might get around to arranging your bridge work, honky.
Let's all be peaceful.
Ah, stuff it. Claiborne in 5 minutes. Last stop.
Fred was finally able to speak. All conversation stopped. Mouths agape, gestures frozen, eyes locked on the driver's cap or back or Adam's apple, arrested as if the announcement were extraordinary, of great import. They might have been in the playground playing red light, green light, 1, 2, 3, or in a mime studio mastering statues, or in white jackets at a healing session watching the sutures on a woman's wrists turn from black to maroon to pink to flesh, and staring at the healer, forced to acknowledge something more powerful than skepticism, and be stunned still. They might have been leaning against a stack of bedsheets while Doc Surge, holding forth in the linen closet, explained the symbols on a dollar bill, translating carefully Novus Ordo Seclorum to them and the boy Buster standing mute and immobile. They might have been in the corner pool room instead of whizzing past it, bars, a church, a funeral parlor at 55 miles an hour in a 35-mile zone. Might have been in Shorty's pool hall in the exact moment when Shorty rushed to the back, skidded into the corner of the gambling table, and warned through clenched teeth, the man. And had been caught in the frozen tableau till some magical bit of stage business registered in the brain as the thing to be doing to render the self invisible to the law. They might have been sitting on a white stool as the patient, or on a wooden bench in a locker room as the patient's husband, or in the driver's seat, clamping down hard, throat and stomach hot and moist and like a rock, holding still the rage and regret threatening to be thrown up from the depths of the self, all covered with slime.
They might have been 27 miles back in the moment of another time when Fred Holt did ram the bus through the railing and rode it into the marshes, stirring bacteria and blue-green algae to remember they were the earliest forms of life and new life was beginning again. In the sinking bus, trying to understand what had happened, was happening, would happen, and stuck still, but for the straining for high thoughts to buoy them all up. But sinking into the marshes, thick with debris and intrusion, faces frozen at the glass, seeing with two eyes merely the onlookers on the embankment holding their breath, or seeing closer by with two eyes the bullfrogs holding theirs in the shallows, the dragonflies suspended over the deeps and the wind waiting, the water still and waveless till the shock of the plunge registered and the marshes sucked things under. Silence on the bus, as at a momentous event, but an event more massive and gripping than the spoken word or an accident. A sonic boom, a gross tampering of the weights, a shift off the axis, triggered perhaps by the diabolics at the controls or by asteroids powerfully colliding. Earth spun off its pin, the quadrants slipping the leash, the rock plates sliding, the magnetic fields altered, and all, previously pinned to the crosses of the zodiac and lashed to the earth by the fixing laws, released. A change in the charge of the field so extreme that all things stop and are silent until the shifts complete and new radiations open the third eye. J.D. His fingers splayed out on the horn case, trying to connect with the music. A tune had caught him and held him in a moment when speech, movement, thought were not possible. Something in an idiom that had to be attended to from the total interior, captured, defended. The humming sonorous from his center now was making him eager to get to the Regal Theater in Claiborne to echo it all after 6 long years of dumbness behind the walls. My Sister of the Rice, coming unstuck from the web of time and place, was in the fish canaries of Alaska, the sugar plants of Hawaii, Farm Valley, California, Manila Town, Chinatown, Japantown, all over at once, calling together in a single moment the Sisters of the Rice to caucus. Iris, Sister of the Plantain, loosening, was back in Barnwell, handing out no nuke flyers and turning in time to have an angry woman with a baby slung over her back rush up to her and spit, "Sun lover," in her face, an echo of what others like her, misrecognizing who and what she was, had spat out years ago, "Nigger lover." Fred and Wanda in the bedroom, oblivious to the noise of the elevator on the other side of the wall. The two of them smack up against each other like two halves of ancient fruit, succulent and sweet and no cleaving on the horizon. Nilda was in the hills, readying for the medicine dance, having dreamed the dream that could release her any time from the earth's bands. She was waking again to the thundering of white buffalo and the call of coyote to join the peyote gatherers to dance the dance not danced in 30 years. Palma was walking into the infirmary's treatment room as bus